Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
In this episode, Ilona sits down with Paul Michael of Peter Michael Winery.
They do, and delicious wine, by the way.
Thank you.
It has uncommon elegance and refinement, which again is a recurring theme. Is there a particular vintages that you're a big fan of with respect to that bottling?
These wines get better and better because the vines are relatively young.
Okay.
So that's my first response to that. So they are, they're 10 years old. No, they're 13 years old now. So I think they're beginning to really show their potential. I think, last night I had a 2012 Le Caprice, which was absolutely beautiful.
Mm.
So that was how I welcomed myself onto the property here.
That is a very nice welcome. On the practical side, do you have library vintages in your cellar that are available to the consumers?
the short answer to that is sadly not.
Oh.
We don't. We are asked about that a lot.
I'm certain that you do.
We keep. Depends on what you define as a library vintage, of course, but available. We keep some to have a library ourselves to have our history and to bring them out on special occasions here when we're here, when we're entertaining as well. So for sure we keep a small library, but we don't have a release program for library vintages though.
Got it.
And we get asked all the time.
Given your winemaking philosophy and the quality and the continuity and the fact that this wine show up so differently every time you put your lips to them, so to speak. Obviously, unless you were on the mailing list throughout the years and were smart enough to realize that this wine's really they don't need to be sold. They actually remarkably can be enjoyed early in life. But short of that, the only other options for you guys, I guess, is chasing it at auctions or something like that, which is always an interesting proposition in terms of how the integrity of the cellar. Mm-hmm. But your wines are such poignant examples to me of that mentality when they were crafted to be enjoyed throughout life experience. And I was joking, but tasting some of them in the 90s, that they might outlive me. And it's still the case, isn't it? What you craft today could very well last for decades.
Yes. Yes, I hope so. Yeah. As Peter said earlier, we do have surprises from time to time. I've had a Chardonnay, a single vineyard Chardonnay brought to me at dinners in various parts of the world,
mm-hmm.
by a collector or by a connoisseur, mm-hmm. and that are 20, 21, 22 years old, and they're tasting absolutely beautiful. I've had that taste served to me blind once as well, and I had no idea what was about to happen, but it's always a nice surprise.
That must be so gratifying. I remember tasting, I believe it was in 98, actually, out of a large format of Le Pavot, and that's when that comment popped to mind. That wine, mm-hmm. was built to last. It was magnificent, enormous, and so incredibly generous, yet there was so much more, mm-hmm. that will be happening.
Well, Nick Morlay is our current winemaker.
Yeah.
And Nick says that, we're talking about Le Pavot, for example,
yeah.
He says these are wines built for 20 to 30 years.
Oh.
Yeah, so we are still counting.
Not to argue with the winemaker, but I think there's more than 30 years in those wines. it must be so incredibly gratifying for you to run into consumers in various contexts and occurrences and have them talk to you about their experience with your wines. What is that like?
Important.
Yeah.
I think is my quick answer to that. And it's enjoyable. It's why, you know, I go out, just, I go around the US once or twice a year with Peter here. Meet a lot of people who love our wines, introduce the wine to more people along the way, inevitably, and that's what we want to do. And I do the same in Asia as well, and a tiny bit of that in Europe as well. So, and in the UK where we live. So, and it's just really important to first of all tell these stories and share a little bit of what's behind the wines.
Mm-hmm.
So, because many people, well, we have a complicated portfolio.
Yeah,
it's kind of Burgundian in character.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different bottlings. So that needs explaining, and the stories behind the wines need explaining, and the terroir. And so that's really important. And people really don't appreciate that. Even people who've been collecting the wines for a long time, it can often be the case. But also, it's just great to have the, and important to have the feedback from people about what they think of the wines we're making today, how they've evolved, what their favorite wines are.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good interaction.
You've had such a long-standing love affair with your wines and wine world in general. You were introduced early on, and that's very valuable because it kind of calibrated you, in a sense. And now you've been so intimately involved with your own brand. And there's been, obviously, a tremendous following. You know, wine... clearly was considered easily one of the cult wines in California from relatively early days. And people really coveted them. How has the consumer base changed? And even more importantly, those people that have that curiosity about your wine, that maybe are a bit younger and really don't know the depth of your story, maybe have heard of them, or maybe even haven't. What's your message to those folks that have the desire to get to know you? How would you like to be introduced and known?
Okay, that's a great question. So I think the... how has it evolved over time? I can answer that in the immediate today, because I think there's a fundamental shift happening in terms of awareness of climate and importance of sustainable farming and all mm-hmm. those practices that I think everybody is talking about in the wine industry. So I'll come back onto that. But in terms of I find it amazing. Well, I shouldn't find it amazing, but you know, you have people who have known our wine for a long time, known the brand for a long time. Can I just pause?
Yeah, of course, absolutely.
Yeah, so I've got a frog in the throat.
Certain vision of, you know, Sir Peter would call it making wine in California with European sensibility. So mm-hmm. the idea that balance, finesse and elegance were valued over power. And the idea was that the wines should speak about the place that they were made. Sir Peter talks about relaying that vision to Helen Turley in what he called a surprisingly short conversation, because Helen immediately understood the vision. The first wines, based on how Helen chose to make them with these classical artisanal winemaking techniques, were somewhat groundbreaking. And, you know, I don't mean that to sound self-congratulatory, but they were extraordinarily well received critically and in the market. And because there wasn't a lot of them, and they were really only available in Northern California and Metro New York, that had people calling us and asking if they could buy them. And at the time, consumer direct shipping of wine was something that was sort of flying under the radar of regulation. It was just, we started a mailing list and it just grew organically from there.
Mailing lists were not common then either.
They weren't common then.
And you couldn't ship to many places either,
exactly.
Right?
So again, yeah. Marketing challenges galore.
Yeah.
Well, actually, in the early days, you could ship anywhere because it wasn't regulated. And then it became regulated and became much more more difficult.
Mm.
But over time, the mailing list grew to be approximately 2/3 of the case volume of the winery.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up needing to basically put a cap on it because we really wanted the wines to be available in wholesale distribution as well. So at this point, we are in something like 32 U.S. states and 15 export markets. And in the U.S., about 70% of the wine that goes into wholesale distribution is in restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still relatively rare to walk into a wine shop and find Peter Michael just sitting there waiting for you.
So that, again, that strategy, it is a strategy, isn't it?
It evolved into a conscious strategy, but there was never a master plan from the very beginning.
Okay.
It's something that really came online very organically,
mm-hmm.
And evolved as the wineries grew, developed, and the portfolio got broader.
And then we took that mailing list online. We were probably one of the first to do that, I think, and which was also quite brave to do. At the time, and I think there was for a while, some people on paper and some people were online and by email, and that then gave another lease of life and future to our fan base and people who know us and helped spread the word a bit, and at the same time our production's grown. So,
mm-hmm.
We've been making approximately 20,000 cases of wine for quite some time now,
mm-hmm.
But going back a bit. Yeah, that was 10,000 cases of wine, and I'm not sure when that was, Peter. Do you remember when we last made 10,000 cases of wine?
Well, I've been here since 2006, and it was before my time.
Before your time, okay.
Yeah, we were probably 14,000-15,000 cases of wine when I got here in 2006.
There you go. So, I mean, steady growth, and that will continue a little bit. We have vineyards that have been planted.
Mm-hmm.
Up on the hill here to add a little bit here and there and with various of our wines. The O'Parity Vineyards had a lot of work done to it and that'll come on stream, and Le Pavot has been going through quite a lot of work and reorientation as well,
mm-hmm.
Long-term improvement. And so when all those come on stream, we'll be making a little bit more than we're making at the moment.
And it sounds like you're in a constant state of improvement of your existing vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit more about what that piece of it is like in terms of viticulture, in terms of technology perhaps, tweaking and major changes, anything there to share?
Sure. I think we are, first of all, a lot of capital investment always going back in. It's part of the cycle of making wine. So you need to have that long-term vision and know you can stay the course.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're constantly doing that. It might be why there's not a lot of library wine around, by the way, because we like to sell in order to keep on doing this. I think let me focus the answer onto Le Pavot Vineyard, I think.
Okay.
I mean, there's several, we're working in all sorts of areas.
Mm-hmm.
So Le Pavot Vineyard, those vines date to the early 90s, mm-hmm. Most of them. We've sort of replanted post phylloxera through the sort of early 90s to mid 90s, I think, roughly. And that's now mm-hmm. coming up to be 25 years ago, roughly. Some of those vines do need to be replanted,
yes,
for various reasons.
Of course.
So what we are doing is reorientating a lot of the rows to be north-south, mm-hmm. right? So we planted east-west. That was the wisdom at the time on the mountainside. I think when Nick, maybe Luke, Nick joined us, we all understood that long-term we all really ought to be doing it that way. So it gives a better midday protection.
Yeah.
And better exposure in the morning and the evening. So that's the major thing, and that's a plant. That's a program that goes probably over 15 years, probably.
Wow, that's a huge commitment right there.
And we are probably one third of the way through that right now.
My goodness.
so that's one thing we're doing, and then we've actually purchased an existing vineyard. This is. Only the second time we've ever done that, which is up behind us. We wrote about it in our last newsletter. Mm-hmm. So this is going up a little higher, and it's currently planted with mostly Cabernet grapes, but we will bud over and in some cases replant completely and reorientate again, mm-hmm. to Chardonnay, to help ease that shortage of Chardonnay.
Yes.
Which is one of our Achilles' heels.
Yes.
It's a nice problem to have, but we just think the higher altitude there will be more suited to the Chardonnay. In mm-hmm. fact, one part of it is probably an extension to Marbelfi because it's right neighbouring there.
Wow.
So, and then in the Oparity vineyard, and we'll come on to Oparity in a minute, which is in Napa. Mm-hmm. There we've been. Replanting from other varietals since we purchased that in 2009, there was some Sangiovese grapes there which we took out and have replaced with mostly Cabernet Sauvignon mm-hmm. and Cabernet Franc.
Obviously, yeah. Lots of projects going on.
So always lots of projects going on. Yeah.
It sounds like you inform your subscribers. You mentioned the newsletter, so.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be on your mailing list, and I thought I'd read cover to cover.
Well, that's good to hear.
It's very informative.
Excellent. Good.
It's actually, honestly, some of the best written material I've ever received as a consumer. And it sounds like it's still ongoing, right?
It is. Wow, that's very flattering. Thank you.
No, it's the truth. And it's really interesting, that relationship with the consumer, whether you have, you're an existing fan or you're just thinking about joining, I've always advocated that it's always best to have a relationship directly with the winery. I mean,
yeah.
Yes, there are bottle shops and there are people that, obviously can help you procure some of the wine, but having that relationship with the winery is really important. And we talked about the newsletter and how wonderful it is. I was, remember looking forward to them. It's like reading a story that's ongoing, so it's a very special element. And what else can people expect if they subscribe? I mean, do you do special events? Obviously, they get apprised of new releases. And what other value added do people get when they strike a relationship with you directly?
So that's a question we ask ourselves and think about all the time. And you want it to be a personal relationship, and so if you are on the mailing list and you would like to come and visit us, you can come and visit us, and we will book an appointment and give a nice tour and tasting, and you just get to enjoy the property, and I think that's probably the most important.
Of course, it's not open
aspect.
To the public, right?
So we're not open to the public. Mm-hmm. So generally, we will welcome introductions, absolutely. And, we'd love to have more people coming through.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble is, we're small.
Yes.
And so we have a limited capacity. People are on our mailing list and buying our wines and... Mm-hmm. We naturally welcome them and give them kind of a priority.
Wow.
Is that a fair, fair statement? What would you say? We're looking at each other here because this is always like, how can we be more friendly to everybody, and more approachable? And that's what we want to be. But at the same time, you don't want to hammer the property, and the team are small. So,
well, the other tensions. Thing that really needs to be stated very frankly is that the wines are relatively difficult to come by, and the primary advantage of being a mailing list member is access to the wines. So we will have 2 releases a year.
Okay.
The portfolio of 15 wines is split between those 2 releases. So each wine appears in either the spring or the fall. No single wine appears more than once, but people have the access to the whole portfolio, and it would be next to impossible to walk into any kind of a retail environment and have access to the whole portfolio.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, everything you've described in this conversation points to quality, integrity, thoughtful approach. You know, you have never shied away, like I stated earlier, of some formidable challenges. Yeah. And not just a challenge, but it's like almost staggered circumstances, and you faced them head on, no resting on laurels. So given that, even if you hadn't tried the wines, it becomes obvious that quality is there. Stylistically, that's another debate, but the foundational piece is that these wines are worth your time and money. So the practical side is, the best way to do this is to contact the winery, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, people can certainly call us up. Most of our members actually join by simply visiting our website and signing up for our waiting list. The mailing list is full, and we basically add people as people fall off the list. People fall off the list either by their own request or by simply failing to purchase for a period of years.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody hasn't, we haven't heard from somebody in a while, we reluctantly move their account into a sort of a suspended status, and we'll certainly reinstate it if they request, and that makes room for new people to come on.
And we understand that people, I think it's important. We understand that people can't buy our wines a year in, year out, ad infinitum.
Absolutely.
We try to be as accommodating as possible to everybody in that sense.
Excellent.
That said, you know, we've been keeping mailing list records since 1992. And we have people on the list that joined in 1992 and still purchase the wines.
That's so fantastic. That, again, speaks to how special your brand is. Congratulations on that. And in that same vein...
So we should taste a wine.
Yes, we should taste a wine. And I was going to ask Paul a question about... maybe you can share a story from your travels and interactions with your fans that was particularly... touching, curious, entertaining, something that had an impact on you.
Okay. Can we pause?
Absolutely. So we're about to hear a really special story that validates that something we discussed earlier, that the wines last and last and last and can be quite chameleonic in terms of perception. So tell us.
You asked stories from the road, so to speak, and we've had we hear stories of meeting people who met, funeral stories, birth stories, wedding stories. We have all sorts of people with personal stories, but I was in. In Hong Kong in 2016, and Jeannie Cho Lee, the Asian MW, hosted a small dinner with us and a few friends of hers, and brought along a selection of wines and to taste over dinner, and they were blind, and they had tin foil, and she said we were going to have some fun.
That's always promising.
And this was in the China Club in Hong Kong. And so that was great. So she started to reveal these wines over the course of the dinner, and there were a couple of Burgundies came along, and a couple of our fairly current releases, and that was fun. And then there was one, and she poured it out and said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, clearly this is a lovely old Burgundy, a Chardonnay." She had a twinkle in her eye, and I could see. And then she revealed, and it was Bellecote 1996, a 20-year-old single vineyard Chardonnay from here. That was a lovely surprise, because I think everybody just didn't see that one coming at all.
Yeah.
At least for me. So evidence of a single vineyard Chardonnay, with great age worthiness.
Absolutely.
And I've had a few, it often has been Bellecote since, people bringing one to a dinner. And as I just heard just now, or reminded just now, we did make Le Caprice and Clos du Ciel were Chardonnays originally that we made, but they were non-estate Chardonnays. And so as we became estate, 100% estate grown, we discontinued those wines. But when the Pinot Noirs came along, we thought, well, we can reuse them, and that's what we do. And it's never been an issue for us in the marketplace. But a Clos du Ciel did turn up. A Clos du Ciel Chardonnay did recently turn up at a dinner, and it was a Chardonnay. And my colleague didn't know the history and was totally confused. So there you go.
I just want to highlight the estate piece as well, because you've made such a concerted effort to not only acquire some very really phenomenal vineyards for a specific set of reasons, without a doubt, but also your 28-year relationship with your vineyard manager, which means that remarkable continuity, and again, that intimacy, breadth and depth of knowledge of the land that he possesses, and understanding of philosophy. And the winemaking succession, which you mentioned some of the who's who of New World, without a doubt, that people like Mark Aubert and Vanessa Wong struck up on their own and created their own brands.
And so did Luc Morlet.
And Luc Morlet,
as well.
Yeah. So you had such a diverse group of people working here in the winemaking capacity, and yet your wines had this theme going forth from the inception till now, that again, there are variables and there's what's so important is that fundamental philosophy that seemed to permeate. Is that deliberate? Is it something that you discuss?
I think it is pretty deliberate, yes. That is one instruction that we do make pretty clear when we have a new winemaker join us, is you can improve the wine, just please don't change the style of the wine. Stay consistent with what we're making, what we're about. And that's been the rule. And then we've added to the portfolio as we've gone. So Nick has been here for a number of years now. Nick is Luke's younger brother. So when Luke moved on in 2005 and subsequently started his own Morlet family estates, he introduced us to Nick.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.